I've never done my best work at night. I am an early morning sort of guy. Most at peace when the light is just beginning to reach over the horizon. A day is full of possibilities. As soon as the light tilts the other way, fading, I feel heaviness and apprehension. Even as a child, I was a lousy sleeper. I would awake in the middle of the night to fears that seemed to have magnified in the hours since my bedtime. And my mind would spiral away from reality, following every worry to its most catastrophic end. Still now, as often as not, between the hours of like 3 and 5 in the morning, I am awake. The wolving hour, someone I used to know called it. When the monsters slip out of your head and fill the space around you. A time when everybody else is asleep and unreachable, and it feels like you are left to wrestle your fears alone, the only person in the whole entire world. In her book, Dark Night Journey, the Quaker teacher Sandra Cronk writes that one of the most powerful pathways in the journey to God is the time of stripping and emptiness, called by many the dark night. It describes the situation of those who have had a growing sense of relationship with God and are suddenly bereft of the experience of God's presence or direction or consolation. Just as a journey to a new location is full of confusion and misgiving when made on a moonless night, so the nighttime spiritual journey is a bewildering occasion, she writes. Aridity, meaninglessness, loss, and pain are our most frequent companions, hardly the milestones we expect in a journey toward God. Yet this is a journey toward God. The problem is that as we come closer, we expect to be able to see our pathway more easily. But on the contrary, clear seeing is not as we had imagined it. These days, the world feels very dark, no matter the time of day. I have been awake many nights, worrying about people snatched from their homes for expressing opinions the government does not like, worrying about how we are reversing environmental protections now when time has nearly run out to prevent the worst impacts of climate change. Worrying about whether my friends will lose access to healthcare, about whether we will all lose our jobs if the economy collapses. I think about what I would take with me if I needed to quickly leave my home and go somewhere safer. I think about all the powerful institutions capitulating to autocratic demands. I think about how so many people in positions of power could take so much delight in cruelty. I think about all the visions I had for what my life might look like in the next year and preemptively grieve the loss of all those ordinary, beautiful things. It feels to me like the situation in front of us is one of impossibility. I cannot see a way out. I cannot see a path through it that doesn't involve a lot of suffering and pain and destruction for a lot of people. I cannot see God. The passage we read tonight was written for the Jews of the 6th century BC, who were emerging from a period of unprecedentedly profound trauma. They had lived through the Babylonian exile, which was a time of horrific violence. There had been a famine in Jerusalem, and the city was under siege, then conquered and destroyed. The Jews' homes had been razed, their families separated. The Book of Lamentations includes descriptions of violence against children and the elderly. Thousands of those who were not killed were deported. In the final stage of the exile, the temple, which was God's home on earth, was destroyed. One commentator writes that it is difficult for the modern person to comprehend the sense of spiritual and emotional devastation that the Old Testament Jew would have felt upon witnessing the destruction of this building. In Dark Knight Journey, Sandra Cronk writes that the most common way that modern people of faith experience God is through creation. We look for signs of God in the natural world, in the care shown to us by other people. We make meaning out of the dyings and risings of our own lives, as we often say at St. Lydia's. She argues that dark nights, though, are times when we cannot see any signs of God at all. And these are perhaps even more important to the process of knowing God. During a dark night, we want the darkness to go away. We grasp for meaning, try all the things that have worked in the past to come near to God, really lean in, and none of them work. All that we have lost may remain lost, Cronk writes. The dark night reminds us of a God who is, in Cronk's words, beyond all our visions or thoughts. Our best attempts to explain or find expression inevitably fall short of the reality of God. Our experience and absence is part of our encounter with that which is beyond our knowing. During the dark night, we have to put down what we think we know, what we usually do. There's nothing to do, actually. Cronk writes that part of why she believes that a dark night is the most important part of a faith journey is that it shows us that God's presence is not something we earn by how hard we pray or how much we believe. It is something given to us freely out of love, wine and milk without money or price. The Jews were detained in Babylonia for 50 years. Isaiah 55 is the last section of what is called the Book of Comfort, which was written for the Jews when the exile had ended. They had to rebuild their lives, their city, their temple, acts of deep faith and imagination. The prophet's less than coveted job, one commentator notes, is to speak a life-giving word of hope when all events seem to point to the contrary. The heading that my version of the text gives and that we read tonight is an invitation to abundant life. In it, God restates God's promise to the Jews, an everlasting covenant with them, one marked by steadfast, sure love. I can imagine the response somebody might have had to hearing the words of Isaiah 55 after everything they had recently suffered. Skepticism would have been fair, among other maybe worse things. And it feels like God anticipates this. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, the prophet writes, nor are your ways my ways. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. We can never fully know. We can never fully understand. The promise God has made is not that horrible things won't happen. The Bible is filled with horrible things. More than one writer has noted that it is miraculous that the Jewish faith survived the Babylonian exile at all. So painful and soul-breaking was that time. And in spite of what surely must have felt like a long night of darkness and abandonment, some Jews chose to have faith that no matter what comes, God's love will be steadfast. God's love will be sure. And we know now, too, from our modern perspective, that God is not only distant and sometimes absent, but also mysteriously present, human, being tormented in the desert, celebrating at a wedding, passing a night sleepless in a garden, dying on a cross. At the end of every dark night, there is birdsong. The birds begin before the light has changed. I know this as somebody often awake when it is dark. Even in winter, there are one or two twittering, calling out. And then the light does change. There is always dawn. Every morning I try again to believe in a God who makes a way where there is no way. I don't know how or when that way will appear. And I'm forever trying not to despair at how long it seems to take. Sometimes I recite the promise in my mind. You shall go out in joy and be led back in peace. The mountains and the hills before you shall burst into song, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. Instead of the thorn shall come up the cypress. Instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle. And it shall be to the Lord for a memorial, for an everlasting sign that shall not be cut off.